You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live Podcast. The Fountainhead, Part 1, Chapters 1 through 8.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fountainhead Reading Discussion Group. My name is Ben Baer. I'm coming to you live from the Ayn Rand Institute in California. Would like to start out with a few announcements about the purpose and the nature of this group. And once I'm done with that, my colleague Keith Lockich is going to join me, and we'll start digging into this first section of Ayn Rand's great work, The Fountainhead, the first eight chapters, which I hope many of you in attendance have had the chance to read. So I'll start by saying that if you are watching this right now on one of our social media channels, if you're watching on Facebook or on YouTube, we're glad to have you there. But if you want to be able to participate more actively in this discussion, say by asking questions or by commenting in a way that we can interact with you, the best way to do that is to participate through Zoom. On the screen here, you'll see a URL, a link where you can register for our Zoom broadcast. You should be able to get in within just a couple of minutes. And that way you're going to be able to send us questions and make comments in the chat. For those of you who are in Zoom, I'm going to give you a few instructions on how to do that in just a minute. Otherwise, I also want to tell you about one of the big reasons we're doing these reading groups is to, we know that a lot of people are at home right now. We know you're looking for things to read and think about and maybe even work on. And well, for those of you who are in high school, I think grades 11 and 12, maybe 10th grade too, I can't remember. There's a scholarship contest that the Ayn Rand Institute sponsors. It's one of the biggest essay contests in the world. The top prize is $10,000. If you go to this website or otherwise look up Ayn Rand essay contests on Google, you're going to be able to find more information on the topics that you can write essays on, how to submit them. We've moved the deadline back until late in May, by which time we will have finished reading this book in the group. So hopefully some of the things we talk about in this group will be helpful for those of you who are working on these essays and want to enter the contest. So I'm going to now turn my screen share off, and hopefully we'll be joined momentarily by my colleague, Keith Lockich, who's gonna start discussing Hi. Some of this with us.
And, hi, Ben. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Keith.
Just to clarify, the Fountainhead Essay Contest is open to 11th and 12th graders.
Okay, right? I knew it was 11th and 12th. I couldn't remember if it was 10th.
Yeah.
But the Anthem Contest is out there for 10th graders.
Well, Anthem is open to 8th. There are two contests, actually, for Anthem, 8th, 9th, and 10th. And then there's another contest for 11th and 12th graders. So.
Yeah. Someone just asked in Zoom, once they're registered for Zoom, will the link remain the same? And I believe the answer to that question is yes. So for those of you who are watching in Zoom, we're going to do two forms of interaction with you today. One is we've posted previously some discussion questions about this first reading. I don't know if you had a chance to see them, but if you're looking to think about discussion questions in the future in advance of the webinars, those are posted both on that Zoom registration page I mentioned before, but also on the Fountainhead Facebook page. We'll try to put those up a little earlier next week than they were last week. So you can read those questions, think about them as you're reading through the book. And if you like, post your own thoughts on the answers in the comments sections on Facebook. We'll take a look at what you've said. Maybe we'll integrate some of that into our discussion. But otherwise, today we're going to talk about those questions. The discussion is going to be structured around them. I'm going to be reminding you, the audience, what those questions are. I'm going to be asking you to participate in the conversation. So the best way to do that is through the chat box. If you hover over your screen, on the bottom, you'll see a button that says chat. It'll open up a little module to the right in Zoom. And when I ask questions, feel free to try to answer them. Right now, your answers will only be read by us, not anyone else, not any of the other attendees will be able to see what you're writing. So if you have thoughts on questions we ask you, please put them in the chat. We'll take a look at them. We'll see if that contributes to the conversation. We might share some of them. Otherwise, if you want to ask questions, there's a separate button and module for that in Zoom. Hover over the screen. There's a button that says Q&A. If you have questions about the material we're discussing in the moment, put a question there. We'll try to maybe we'll try to work some of your questions in as we're talking about the topic, but certainly we'll save some of them for toward the end when, if we have like a grab bag of a bunch of different questions, we'll go through those too. So
Ben, that seems like a good time to also mention that we're trying to keep this spoiler free. Do you want to say something about that?
Okay. Yeah, so whenever we do events like this, we usually get a mix of different people. Some of whom have read the book many times and love it and just want to talk more about it. Some of whom are reading it for the very first time. And so just want to remind any of you out there, and this is less of a concern since not, you know, not everybody's going to be able to see the comments that you write, but do keep in mind, we're trying to do this in a spoiler-free way. So if you ask a question that reveals spoilers about future events in the novel that we haven't gotten yet, I'm going to pass those over unless there's a way of asking them without that. And the same thing goes, by the way, for thinking about the theme and the philosophic meaning of the book. I think this is something that you have to draw out of the book over time, and especially since we're right at the beginning of our discussion, veterans who know more about the meaning of these events, stay tuned. We'll talk more about that as our discussion goes on in future weeks.
And I can just say a little bit about what is it that we are going to focus on in this session, since we're only covering the very first eight chapters. One of the things I talked about last week is the fact that one of the things that Ayn Rand is doing in the novel is she's showing us how different philosophical principles lead to different life courses. And so what we're starting to see, we're looking kind of at the characters of Rourke and Keating, and we're trying to get a sense of what are the different ideas that they hold and premises that are motivating them, and are we seeing right from the beginning differences in what that leads to in their actions and choices. So
yeah, and I think that especially these introductory chapters are very carefully and consciously put together by the author with the intent to show the differences in character between Rourke and Keating. And some of the questions, some of the discussion questions that we ask were aimed at trying to bring those differences out. And sometimes within the scope of a single chapter, you'll see the most relevant comparisons being made along the exact same dimensions. These are, I think, some of the chapters that she worked the hardest on, took the longest time to write. Things toward the end of the book, she wrote more quickly. And you can really see that coming out in the way that she crafted it. So let's dive right in. I want to start with a question that we actually didn't ask in advance. We didn't post it in advance. But I think it's a question that's going to help transition us into a lot of those questions that we did post, those questions about the differences between Rourke and Keating in particular. The first line of the novel is famous. It's right up there with it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And it's a truth universally acknowledged that a single man with a fortune must be in want of a wife. Instead, we have Howard Rourke laughed. And so for some reason, this is a aspect of Rourke's character that people sometimes forget about, but it's a really important one. And the question that I want to ask is, why is Rourke laughing? What is he laughing about? And if you're here with us in Zoom, this is a great opportunity to write something in the chat to share with us your thoughts on why is Rourke laughing? I mean, he's standing on a cliff, naked. We find out that his situation in life is not exactly what you would ordinarily describe as a humorous situation. We find out that he's just been expelled from school, from an architecture school, the school that, and this is the field that he's studying to pursue a career in, but he's been expelled. Why is he laughing? Somebody in the chat whose name I can't quite read because it's a bunch of numbers, but SM says he's just being, he's feeling free. I think that's right. He's feeling free from something. But what is he feeling free from? Meryl in the chat says he's not devastated by his expulsion. That's clearly true, but why not? Jay says, since the mind can overcome anything, the troubles in life can be amusing. Estrid says he's laughing, inspired by the strength of nature. Bobby says he's impervious to, thanks guys, you're putting great stuff in the chat. He's impervious to failure. His pursuit and vision are paramount. All other opinions are worthless. Ellen says he's happy, but how can he be happy in a moment like this? Elizabeth says he knows he has the power to design the world. Susan says because he loves life. Bonnie, I think, says something really important. He realizes he doesn't need the dean anymore. I assume, Bonnie, you're referring to the dean of the school that he's just been expelled from. I mean, it's clearly the case. He wouldn't be laughing in a situation like this unless he didn't think his expulsion was that important. And some of the things that you've said in the chat, I think, point the way to why he doesn't think it's important. He still wants to be an architect. He clearly still wants to be an architect. That's why he's looking at his surroundings in nature. He's looking at the granite, the trees, the iron rust, all to be used in the construction of buildings. So it seems like he's still pretty confident that he's going to be able to be an architect, even though he's been expelled from school. Now, I don't know if somebody would be able to be in the same position these days when you need to have a license and you can't get a license without a degree, et cetera. But this is presumably in a day and age where that wasn't the case. He seems to think he can still be an architect. The question isn't who's going to let him, is who's going to stop him. And nobody seems to be out there to stop him. And he generally doesn't seem to care so much about the approval of the dean or of the architectural standards that he's opposed to, the ones he's violated in turning in all these assignments that have gotten him expelled. He's interested in formulating his own views about what architecture should look like.
And the comment from Salimatu in the chat, I think, is pertinent. He says he's laughing because he realized that he made the mistake of letting something happen to him. I think that's an interesting point.
I hadn't even thought of that, but I think I agree that it's an interesting point. That's a point that comes out when he's talking to the dean. He let himself go through all these courses, learning things that he didn't even think that he needed. Why did he let that happen? So part of it is that he's perhaps laughing at his own, what he regards as a kind of foolish mistake.
Right. He's learned everything he can at Stanton and he feels that he should have made the decision to leave prior to, you know, and not letting himself get expelled, is part of what he says. So.
Yeah. So I think all of you in the chat are doing a good job with us so far. And so that's maybe a good opportunity right now, because many of your names I don't recognize. Part of the reason that we're doing this series is to reach out to people who are first-time readers of The Fountainhead, people who are unfamiliar with Ayn Rand's works. And I'm gonna put up a poll to get a sense of who you are, where you're coming from. This is just a question about what your familiarity with Ayn Rand is. I'll leave this running in the background so anybody in Zoom can answer it as we continue to talk about this material.
Yeah, I'll apologize to Salimatu, who points out that Salimatu is a she, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name also.
Yeah, we're probably gonna butcher a few people's names today. Yes. Sorry about that. It's too bad that we can't be speaking with you in person to hear how you would pronounce it. But so Keith, I think this question about what Rourke regards as important and what he doesn't regard as important is a good transition now to the next thing that we wanted to talk about. One of the discussion questions we did post about how Rourke's and Keating's reasons for wanting to be an architect differ. And I think you were gonna say that, talk a little bit about that, but we can ask people in the chat too about it as well.
Yeah, so what information do we get in the first eight chapters about Rourke's reasons for wanting to be an architect versus Keating's reasons for wanting to be an architect? And let's take up Rourke first. So I think there's a couple of sources that we can draw on here. There are things that Rourke tells us about why, you know, he says explicitly why he wants to be an architect. And then I think there's some kind of actions that we see in him that reveal that as well. So let's take this as a, let's put this as a question to all of you. What are some of the things that Rourke says about why he wants to be an architect?
And he says different things in different parts of the readings. It's not all in one place. So some of them are earlier, some of them are
just
later.
Some of this is just a matter of kind of digging out and finding the right passage. So one of the things that he says is comes on, if you've got the novel with you, and we're using the student edition here, just if you want to get the pagination right. I have my ancient copy that's broken, and here's the other half. So, but the pages are the same. So on page 26, you know, Rourke talks about, he's talking about why he wants to build, and the dean is talking about the clients. You know, of course, the reason we want to build is so that we can build the house that the client wants us to build. And Rourke says that he doesn't intend to build in order to have clients. He intends to have clients in order to build. So it's the building that is Rourke's passion. It's the act of taking the problem. This is something else that comes out in his conversation with the dean. An architectural job is an intellectual challenge for Rourke. You've got the site, you've got the materials, you've got the specifications, what it is that the purpose of the building serves. And then there's an intellectual challenge of figuring out how to create a building that that meets those specifications, but which also represents a thing of beauty. And it's so that's really what's motivating Rourke. That's what his passion is. He says to Henry Cameron, when he meets him on page 49, Cameron asks him, you know, why he decided to be an architect. And he says, I didn't know it then, but it's because I've never believed in God. And Cameron says, come on, talk sense. What are you talking about? Because I love this earth. That's all I love. I don't like the shape of things on this earth, and I want to change them. So that's Rourke's motivation. So those are some of the things that he says about his motive. But I think it's also interesting to look at some of the actions that he takes. So Bobby in the chat says, Rourke is a true artist. He's inspired by creation and vision. You know, he doesn't take other people's opinions seriously. Let's see, Steve says that he loves designing buildings as an expression of his values. So I think it's interesting to look not just at the things that he says, but also some of the actions. If you look on page 19, I want to recall in the very first chapter. So Rourke comes home from the lake, and he goes back to Mrs. Keating's boarding room where he's living, and she tells him that the dean wants to see him. He's just been expelled from the school, but the dean's office called, and he's got he's got a chance to go and meet with the dean, possibly maybe to get the expulsion reversed. So this is kind of would seem like an important opportunity. He goes back to his room and he starts to kind of pack up. And what happens? He's going through his sketches, and he sees one where he didn't quite know what was going wrong with it. And he suddenly sees the way to fix it. And what does it say? He flung the sketch down on the table. He bent over it. He slashed lines straight through the neat drawing. He stopped once in a while and stood looking at it, his fingertips pressed to the paper as if his hands held the building. Blah, blah, blah. An hour later, he heard a knock at his door. You know, Mrs. Rourke, or Mr. Rourke, Mrs. Keating comes in. Mr. Rourke, what are you doing? What about the dean? He completely forgot about the dean, right? He's what his passion in life is architecture, building. This is the primary thing that's motivating, to the point where to the exclusion of all other things that might be motivating him. There's a similar passage. After he leaves the dean's office, and he wanted to think about the dean and the principle behind the dean, and then it says that he kind of forgets about it. I'll just read this again briefly. He stopped. He saw the sunlight of late afternoon held still in the moment before it was to fade on the gray limestone of a string course running along the brick wall of the Institute building. He forgot men, the dean, and the principle behind the dean, which he wanted to discover. He thought only of how lovely the stone looked in the fragile light, and of what he could have done with that stone. So these scenes show implicitly where Rourke's passions lie, and I think they really show his reasons for wanting to be an architect. Now,
I was just going to say one thing though that's interesting about that last passage is, it's not like Rourke has just an autistic focus on only one thing. He is interested in why people do things that they do, and he wants to understand other people, including people like the Dean. But that last scene is a way of showing that there's what comes first in his mind is his work. Even when the other people involved in his life are ones who are, you know, at least pretty obviously related to his work, the Dean of the architecture school.
So what about Keating? So why does Keating want to be an architect? And that's maybe a trick question, because does he even really want to be an architect?
Well, what are his reasons for going into the field is another way of putting it.
Yeah, there's a good question. So let's see, people are, okay. First answer from Akanshu, because his mother told him to. Bobby says, Keating is a poser to please his mother. His mother wants it, right?
Well, why does his mother want him to go into the field?
Mother knows best.
She has a reason herself.
Okay, so Ben says, different Ben says, it's because his mom thought it was a respectable profession.
Maudie says it sounds prestigious. Humira says that
you
too.
You meet the best people in this field, right? So, unlike Rourke, we don't see any evidence in Keating of a passion for the practice, the activity of architecture itself. What he's interested in is, first of all, his mother. He has this early interest in being a painter, but his mother says, "Oh, well, you know, that's not as respectable a profession as being an architect. And the architect, you meet the best people." And, you know, as we see later in the first eight chapters, right, when he starts to work for Guy Franken, this is an architecture firm where wealthy people are coming to have them build their homes. So when she says you interact with you meet the best people in this line of work, this is the kind of thing she's referring to. It sort of puts you in the path of, you made a Pride and Prejudice reference earlier, Ben. Well, this puts you in the path of other rich men. So that's another Pride and Prejudice reference. But so it's, what he wants is not necessarily to practice the profession of architecture. What he wants is for people to be perceived, to be admired as a great architect, to be perceived as a great architect, you know, to achieve success in the eyes of others. And there's the very telling line on page 37, so after his triumphant graduation, he's the top student, he's got landed this prestigious job, right? And he's going off to celebrate with his friends in the car, driving up to Boston. He was free, he was ready. In a few years, his name would ring like a horn, ripping people out of sleep. He was ready to do great things, magnificent things, things unsurpassed in architecture.
Fill in the blank, but it need to have something you're going to do great things.
Yeah.
It's an afterthought to him, and it's an afterthought in part because there was actually one thing we found out was that there was something he did actually want to do. He wanted to be a painter, but his mother quashed that, he let her quash that in him.
Yeah.
And this is somewhat speculative on my part but there are places in the book where you see Keating looking at the world in a way that a painter would. Like there's a place on page 32 where he sees an electric globe in the air of a spring night, made the street darker and softer. There's other passages like that later where Keating's looking at the world. He looks at the world like a painter would. So there's something in his soul that wants to do that, but he's suppressing it.
I mean, in Ayn Rand's writing style, she often has very visual descriptions. Do you think that there's evidence that, particularly when she's describing things that Keating sees, that there's a difference there? That's interesting.
There's a few places where it's clearly coming from Keating and where there are descriptions like that. There's a few more later, even in this reading, where he's meeting with Katie. But it is, that is somewhat speculative.
Yeah, on my that's part. It's an interesting idea.
So
I think already we're starting to see really big differences between these two characters.
So there's differences in their reasons for going into the field. This is a difference in their souls. We said before that the theme of the book, at least as Ayn Rand described it, was individualism versus collectivism, not in politics, but in man's soul. We're starting to inch our way into the meaning of that theme when we see the different reasons of these two main characters. And one question to be thinking about as we go through this is, well, which one of those souls is the individualist soul? Which one is the collectivist soul? What does that mean? How would you conceptualize the difference between the reasons that Rourke and Keating have? But the way that they look differently on the inside is something that we as readers have a privilege of accessing. There's also the story of how people in the actual story see these characters differently. And one thing that we get throughout the first eight chapters is there's a very distinctive way in which other characters react to Rourke. Sometimes you hear this reaction from Keating, sometimes from just people on the street, but people on the street and people that Rourke comes in contact with feel uncomfortable in his presence. They feel threatened in a way by his presence. And one of the questions that we asked, one of the discussion questions that we posted was, why do you think that is? Why do they feel so uncomfortable? Why do they feel threatened? And do you think this makes sense? Is it a good reason? Do they have a reason, a good reason to feel threatened? And so that's something I'd be interested to hear about from people in the chat again. Why do they feel so threatened by Rourke? And is it a good reason? And I'll just...
threatened and even there's an element of resentment sometimes. So Steve in the Q&A was asking, why does he sometimes arouse resentment in strangers?
And we're already getting a number of people commenting on this. Zev says people feel threatened because he does not virtue signal. That's a contemporary expression, but he doesn't show off how he's supposed to be conforming with certain standards. Maybe that's what you mean. That there might be something to that. Johnny says they sense his. There must be a typo here, but they sense his truth. Something about his truth. Estrid says that he's reassuring. Now there actually are places where Keating finds something about Rourke reassuring, but Keating also feels threatened and uncomfortable. So why are those two going together? There's something, I think there is a connection, and we'll talk more about that later. And there are people, by the way, wondering where they can see the questions that are being, the chat that's being posted. This is something that only we, the panelists, can see right now, and that's by design. But we will try to share with you the comments that you send to us, and you guys are doing a great job sending them, so please keep it up. Helen says...
just as a comment on that, we didn't want... Sometimes if private chatting is happening, it can be very distracting for other participants, and so we turned that off just so that we can help people to keep focused on the discussion here. So.
Yeah. Alexandra says, he doesn't show the people what they would like to be seen as. He sees them for what they are and not the face people put on, Elizabeth says he does not need the approval of other characters, and so he does not fake the conventional reaction. Judith says his purity and directness make others feel uncomfortable because they feel knowledge of their own guilt and betrayal. Yeah, these are some really good responses. I mean, one thing we see on page 17 is that when he looks at them, people feel like they don't exist. Well, why don't they feel like they exist? The dean at one point says he feels threatened. He then checks that. But then at the end of their conversation, he says, no, you are dangerous. At one point in his internal dialogue, he associates great men with criminals. And again, later page 47, we're told the people lose their sense of their own existence in Rourke's presence. Why would that be? I mean, has he displayed any actual signs of violence? Has he ever threatened anyone physically at any point? It doesn't seem like it's a physical thing. It's something more about the way that Rourke looks at people, what he sees in them, what he doesn't see in them, the way he himself carries himself in a way that's different from the way they carry themselves. I don't think we're going to get a full answer to this question of why he is so threatening to people or why he makes them feel uncomfortable until later in the book. There is a point in one of the later chapters, even from today's readings, where I think we get a slightly more explicit answer to this question, but I think we need to go through some other material before we get to that. And I hope we can at least close with that.
We can. One thing we can do, though, is we can look at, by contrast, why do people feel comfortable in Keating's presence? Yeah. And we see him in these eight chapters putting a real focus on making a special effort to look at people and smile and worm his way into a community, whether it's at Franken's office where he goes to work or with his friends at school. It's a major focus of his to make people feel like he's a likable guy and to feel at ease around him. And so I think we can see already that that's not something that Rourke does or would want to do. He's not going to put any kind of special effort into doing that.
There's something about Rourke that challenges people for who they are in a way that Keating doesn't.
So we got a question here in the Q&A about, is Rourke's hair color significant in this? Is this, is there some significance? I think with respect to what we're talking about right now, do you have a comment on that, Ben? Or?
Well, she had to pick some kind of physical appearance for him. She usually gives a very explicit and detailed visual imagery of what all of her major characters look like. And it's probably important for Rourke that he stands out from the crowd in some way. Yeah. So having a very bright red hair, the exact color of ripe orange rind, that you need that kind of image to be memorable as a character, but then also to, you know, this is a person who is going to stand out. I don't think that she thought that everybody who had this color hair had Rourke's character, but
be an individualist, you need to go and dye your hair orange.
Right. I think you wanted then to talk more about some of the differences between them, both in regards to, there's a way of looking at their character through the lens of their reactions, as you mentioned before. And chapter 3 is especially interesting in this regard. It's one of the chapters I was thinking of the most when I said some of these chapters are so carefully crafted in a way that they bring out a contrast in regards to the exact same issue along the same dimension. And I think you really see that in chapter 3 because it's both of them are going to work for the first time. They're both going to their first day of work or trying to get a job. They're both going into an office building where there's an architecture firm. But the way they do this and what happens to them as they go, you know, through the front door and what they're thinking about is very different. And I think, Keith, you wanted to bring out some of these differences.
Yeah, I don't recall if we're explicitly told this, but I think it might be that it's the first time that either of them have actually gone to New York. So they're going to New York to pursue their jobs, but this is also the first time they're in the city. And you know, it's worth saying that New York had a kind of special place in Ayn Rand's heart, you know, because it was the center of culture and finance and the world the buildings of New York, the skyscrapers, she viewed as representing such a monumental human achievement. So what happens when Keating and Rourke both go to New York? So So, well, I guess this is the question that we put as a discussion question so people can try to answer this. Let's talk about Keating first. What is it when Keating arrives in New York? So this is the start of chapter three. What is notable about what he observes and how he what he's like on the first day of the job? So Merrill says Keating is impressed by the glitz of the building. What do we see at the very first paragraph, the second line of the chapter? Peter Keating looked at the streets of New York. The people he observed were extremely well dressed. Right? He's standing in front of the building.
Smart as hell.
He had a great deal to learn. Learn about what? About architecture? No, about how to dress and how to, about what your appearance should be like if you want to be one of the, citizens of New York, right? He goes into the office building. Now, this is also interesting. So he goes into the office building. This is the place where he's been offered a job by Frank, and he's going on his first day of work. And it says, so he goes in and he's observing the architecture and the design of the building. And it says, quite incongruously, Keating felt as if a conveyor belt was under his feet from the moment he crossed the threshold. It carried him to the reception clerk, blah, 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 transferred him to the threshold of a huge drafting room. Why do you think she talks about a conveyor belt there? What does that suggest or indicate?
And remember the conveyor belt because it contrasts interestingly with the way Rourke feels.
So we have...
Myra says mechanical motion.
Gives a visual of how Peter moves through the world. Okay, Jay Marshall says, Keating is being led around, not making his own decisions. Salimati says he's along for the ride.
Yeah.
Judith says he's not in control. Right. The conveyor belt suggests that he's being pulled along. He's not the driver of his own action. He's just being carried along.
And he's being pulled along by these people who are dressed a certain way and the people who've designed this glitzy architecture without his asking any questions about it.
Yeah. Did you want to say a little more about some of the other things we'd noted about Keating? And then I'll come back when we get to Rourke.
Yeah. Even when he gets to inside his office, you see the same kind of being pulled by others attitude. When he sits down at his desk and he's given plans to work on, this is page 38, he feels like it's some other achievement that somebody else has made. He doesn't know how to do the same thing. It's only when he starts to see flaws in people in their appearance sitting around him where he feels what he describes as love for mankind, but it's a love that he has for them because they're there for him to surpass their appearance. So it's still all about appearance in the eyes of others. And even then when he goes to meet the boss, Franken, this is one of those places again where I wonder, first, is it Keating seeing the world in a painterly way? But it's also symbolic of something about the things that he notices as important, because everything looks shellacked and polished. This page 40, liquid mirrors melted and poured over every object. So he's seeing it in this visual way, but at the same time, what's coming out to him is his own reflection. And again, it's all about appearances for him. And when he has a conversation with his boss, especially toward the end, when the boss is examining the drawings that he's brought to him that Stengel had prepared, he realizes that it's been a long time since Franken ever actually studied any of these plans, that he's only doing it for Keating's benefit. And that makes Keating feel light as air. He saw the road to the future. So he recognizes in the person of his boss someone else who's obsessed with appearances. And so there are these kind of mirrors for reflecting off of each other, and you get an infinity. He's been pulled into this office through the conveyor belt, pulled by an obsession with what other people think. And that is the, we're now seeing as the driving motive between him and his boss. And Zev in the chat says, that's the virtue signaling. Well, it's certainly about some kind of signaling. Yeah. It's about signaling to others that you, well, what we'll have to think about what it exactly is being signaled by this kind of behavior.
Yeah, let's jump to the contrast with Rourke. So what about Rourke when he gets to New York? So before we actually see Rourke in New York, that scene is preceded with a whole discussion of Henry Cameron and who he is. We haven't really learned that much about him, and we get a lot of information about him. And the Dana Building is one of his most famous works. And then we see Howard Rourke. Then we meet Howard Rourke in New York. This is on page 46. Howard Rourke looked at the Dana Building beyond the windows, stopping at each landing. He mounted the 6 flights of stairs to Henry Cameron's office. The elevator was out of order. So Ben's smiling. I mean, so this is a situation where he can't just be carried along by the elevator. He has to walk up every single one of those stairs himself, damn it. Did you want to say something about that, Ben? Or?
No, I think you got the main point that I was hoping to bring out there.
But he's simultaneously walking up these stairs, but at every opportunity he gets, he's peering at this view of the Dana Building that he gets out the window, to the point where he almost bumps into somebody because he's too busy looking at the building. And this is his you know, when Rourke gets to New York, he's not looking at people's clothes and how well dressed they are. What's he looking at? He's looking at the buildings of New York. He's wanted to be an architect from you know, a very, very young age. And he's finally in New York, which is, you know, a city that's full of, you know, some of the greatest architectural achievements around. And it tells us, you know, he collided once with a man descending the stairs. This had happened to him often in the last 2 days. He'd walk through the streets of the city, his head thrown back, noticing nothing but the buildings of New York, right? And even when he meets Cameron, he goes into Cameron's office, he and Cameron look at each other, and then Rourke sees a picture or a painting of a building on the wall, drawing of a skyscraper that had never been erected. And what's the first thing he does? He goes and he looks at that picture. So again, radical difference between Keating's first day in New York and the kinds of things that he notices and focuses on versus Rourke's first day, or the first time we see him in New York.
Yeah, I think that's a great chapter that really crystallizes some of the kinds of character differences that we've been talking about so far.
Yeah,
and there are other chapters where the same kind of thing happens.
Yeah, before we get to the next question, Don has a question in the Q&A chat. He says, is it common for persons who've read The Fountainhead and enjoyed it tremendously to use Rourke's clearly shown values to make decisions in their own lives? You know, is Rourke acting as a role model here? And I definitely think that's part of the appeal of The Fountainhead and in Atlas Shrugged, some of the other characters in Ayn Rand's other major novel. You know, there's that phrase, what would Jesus do? Well, I think, you know, people often have the experience of thinking, what would Howard Rourke do in a particular situation? Or they think of some of the other characters in Atlas Shrugged. And just having, this is part of Ayn Rand's view of the role that art can play in our lives, is having the image of a fully developed character and understanding the principles that they act on can help to solidify the answer to that kind of question much more quickly than trying to think it through intellectually. And so I definitely think the characters do play that kind of role model role for people.
So I think that if you're reading this book for the first time, there should still be open question in your mind of, well, which of these characters do I want to try to emulate? One is the role model? There are definitely things we've already looked at about Rourke where I can see why people would want to emulate that. But there's still a lot we have to learn about these characters and what makes them tick. And one way to get into that same issue, I think, is looking at another discussion question that we had posted in advance. How do Rourke and Keating differ in the way they try to advance their careers? They both are trying to advance their careers in some important sense. Let's talk about each of them in that regard. Let's talk first about Keating. Keating's trying to get ahead in the world, clearly. He had to make a decision upon graduating as a valedictorian. What's he going to do next? Is he going to go to the École des Beaux-Arts in Beaux-Arts? I don't know how to say the French. In Paris, or is he gonna go work for Franchomme? And he goes to work in New York. But at that point, he has more decisions about how to get ahead. And so how does he try to get ahead? This is for you in the chat. What's his MO here? What's his strategy for working his way up the corporate ladder, in effect? Angela says, by networking. That's one way of putting some of the things he's doing, but it's. I think we could definitely get more specific than that. It's not just networking, it's at the very least. There's more to it. Bobby says, by drawing inside the lines. So he is sticking with the received standards, but that's really more of his way of keeping his current job. How is he hoping to get ahead in his position? Gretchen says, well, he makes decisions based on how others will see him. Well, what are some of those decisions? Helen says, manipulating people. Sam says, takes advantage of his coworkers. Elizabeth also says manipulating colleagues. What kind of manipulations are we talking about? Scott says climbing on top of others. I mean, he doesn't, at least at this point, doesn't literally kill anybody or leave any bodies in his wake, but he does spot weaknesses in people's performance. That's what Salimatu also says. There's this Tim Davis guy who's obsessed with his girlfriend or his fiance. He's about to get married. He's kind of off in a dream world about it. Keating says, oh, I'll take over your work, Tim. And eventually he's taking over his work so much that the boss realizes he doesn't need Tim anymore. And Keating feels this pleasure at having influenced the course of someone's life. Stengel, at one point he's described as, Keating describes to himself, Stengel as his next step. So he's like seeing other people as stepping stones to get ahead in life. And this is then how he arranges a commission for Stengel so Stengel can go off and start his own firm, which conveniently then leaves him with a promotion.
It's worse than that he arranges a commission for Stengel. He double crosses Guy Franken because he's supposed to secure that commission for Franken's firm.
Right. So, this is something that's, we're just seeing glimmers of it, but at one point later in our reading, page 82, you start to see how Keating is thinking about, oh yeah, Guy Franken has a daughter. I don't know anything about her. I've never met her before, but maybe I should try to nudge my way into that. Who knows? Because if you're dating the boss's daughter, it brings with it all kinds of advantages. But even still, let me ask this of people in the chat. What is Keating not doing to advance his career? And it would be kind of an obvious thing that someone could do if they wanted to do better at work. But what's he not doing? J. Marshall says studying architecture. Conchu says working. And Harsh says working how to learning how to do better. Exactly. Innovating, says
Yeah, that's good.
There's various places where once he's cleared all the other people out of the way and he's gotten their positions, now he's sitting there staring at a blank piece of paper that he has to fill and he doesn't know how to do it and ends up going to Rourke. He even eventually ends up hiring Rourke. And uses Rourke to do the problem solving. Okay, so that's Keating's MO for getting ahead at Franken and Heyer. What about Rourke? What does he do to get ahead to the extent that he can? And by the same token, what doesn't he do? Let's actually start with what he doesn't do, because there are places in the reading where Rourke is actually offered the opportunity to get ahead in certain ways, but he doesn't take it. What are some things he doesn't do? Steven says he doesn't compromise his morality. Well, it's an interesting question what this has to do with morality. There's something he's not compromising. He's certainly not compromising his aesthetic standards. Gretchen says he won't betray his own values. Mahdi says he doesn't change his buildings. These are important points. You see it come up in several places. You see it come up actually first with of all people, Cameron. Cameron is this uncompromising architect of integrity who himself hasn't compromised, but he feels like he's paid a tremendous price for it over the course of his career. And he keeps saying to Rourke, sell out now, compromise. And Rourke doesn't want to do it, even knowing the road to hell that he's about to go through. Even at the end of the end of the reading, Cameron offers him a letter of reference to get a job, and he won't take it. Of course, when he does take a job with Franken, because Keating comes to hire him, because Keating needs him, he insists that he's going to take the job, but only at the price of not having to do any aesthetics. Only if he doesn't have to do any of the front-facing design, he'll work on the engineering aspect of things. And then, of course, when Franken comes to him, when Keating's out at the office, and says, hey, I want you to do this quasi-modern building that sort of looks like some of the stuff that Cameron did, but I want you to compromise on it, Keating says, I can't do it. And that's when he then gets fired. So he has the opportunity to, you know, butter up Franken, just like Keating's been doing, but he doesn't take it.
And I think it's worth pointing out that the very first thing the first opportunity he passes up is the dean's offer to come back to the school. If you wait a year, maybe if you're willing to compromise, you know, don't be so mean to old Professor Peterkin, maybe we'll let you back. And he doesn't want that. He's decided that he's gotten everything he can. He's learned everything he can about architecture from Stanton. But he also knows that he has more to learn. So go ahead, Ben, what does he do?
SM in the chat says he builds honestly. And Johnny says he serves his own function. And I mean, that's the way.
And Marshall says he seeks out a mentor. So he seeks out, Bobby says he seeks out Cameron, you know, even though Cameron is viewed by everybody as a drunken has-been, and you know, by Rourke's judgment, he's decided that that's the person that he can learn from.
Yeah.
The things that he didn't learn at Stanton, the things that he still needs to learn, he knows that he can get them there. And Cameron says to him as he's flipping through his drawings, you know, God, what are you doing here? You have this brilliant idea and then you have to go ruin it. Don't you know how much you have to learn? And what does Rourke say? Yeah, that's why I'm here.
And one of the reasons I've always found that interesting is because, well, we've been stressing up until this point that Rourke looks at the world and at buildings first. He doesn't attach primary importance to people, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't think that he has something to learn from other people. He doesn't think that he knows everything. He doesn't think that he's figured it all out. He's got more growing to do, and he goes to the one person he thinks he knows he can get that from, leaving everybody else aside.
Now, Brian in the Q&A panel says, Franken said he once worked for Cameron. What do you think that was like? Well, we know that Cameron sometimes has to settle for having dolts, you know, doing his drafting for him. Maybe it was something like that. Yeah. I mean, maybe Cameron started out with some promise, but.
So, Keith, we're getting short on time. We have only about 7 minutes left. My thought is that we should skip the last question that we were going to talk about. Maybe I can wrap up with that that summary quotation, though. Sure. And then maybe we should just leave a little bit of time for a general Q&A.
Yeah.
Okay. So we were going to talk about a question about the differences in how Keating and Rourke see and value other people. And some of what we were just discussing actually touches on that. But I wanted to wrap up with a passage that I found and really only noticed for the first time in this latest rereading, which is on page 73. And this is when This is when one of the times when Keating is going to Rourke for help, and he said, and we get a picture of what he's thinking. He says, "Keating felt naked. Davis, Stengel, Franken meant nothing here. People were his protection against people. Rourke had no sense of people. Others gave Keating a feeling of his own value. Rourke gave him nothing. He thought that he should seize his drawings and run. The danger was not Rourke. The danger was that he, Keating, remained." So I think that's a significant passage because it gives us an important clue about why it is that Rourke feels threatening to people like Keating. It's not so much about anything about even Rourke himself, but about what Rourke reveals to them, to these people, about themselves. The way in which he doesn't serve as a reflection for them, in the way that they wanted him to, in the way that they are busy doing for other people all the time. And so I think it's that'll be a useful passage to think about and refer back to as we continue to move forward in the reading. So yeah, we've got about 5 minutes left at this point. I think now's a good time for people to just submit general questions and thoughts about these first eight chapters. Best to put those in the Q&A box.
While we're waiting for questions, so since you mentioned the passage that you kind of that caught your attention on this rereading, there's one thing that there are two passages that caught my attention that I thought were worth mentioning, because in terms of these differences between Rourke and Keating that we're highlighting, I think there's a way in which these two passages almost capture the essence of them. And this is both of them, these are both the scenes where first Rourke and then Keating are walking through the town of Stanton. And on page 16, it says, "People turned to look at Howard Rourke as he passed. Some remained staring after him with sudden resentment. They could give no reason for it. It was an instinct in his presence awakened in most people. Howard Rourke saw no one. For him, the streets were empty. He could have walked there naked without concern." So that's Rourke walking through the streets of Stanton. Then on page 31, we have Peter Keating walking through the streets of Stanton. "He wondered as he walked whether people were looking at him. He watched the rectangles of lighted windows. When a curtain fluttered and a head leaned out, he tried to guess whether it had leaned to watch his passing. If it hadn't, someday it would. Someday they all would." I mean, just reflect on the differences between those two passages, and there's a lot of food for thought there. Okay, let's look at the Q&A. Walter, well, let's see.
I think I want to say something about Brian's question. Brian says, "Some people say Rourke in the later part of the novel is consistent with Rand's philosophy, but in the first part, he isn't. Do you think there's anything wrong with acting like Rourke in the first part?" Well, one question, Brian, here first is, well, what is Rand's philosophy? We haven't really figured that out at this point in the novel, so we'll have to keep thinking about what her philosophy is. But another thing it's worth thinking about is, can a character change in certain regards, but not in others? I mean, as we were just discussing, Rourke doesn't think that he knows it all. Rourke doesn't think he knows everything. He thinks he's got a lot to learn about the world. One of the things we find out at the end of the first chapter is that he wants to figure out what this principle behind the Dean is, what it is that motivates people like the Dean and people like Keating. He doesn't yet understand what motivates them. Maybe once he figures that out, that will change his approach to other people and will change the kinds of things that he allows to let happen to him. Remember, he thought he was making a mistake already at the beginning when he was letting this educational institution get to him in the way that it did.
Yeah, Walter's asking about Keating's relationship with Catherine. I think that's something that we could return to when we get to later chapters, because we see more about their interactions in other chapters. I don't know that we have enough evidence to go on yet.
We don't have a lot, though. I would, without spending much time on it, just point Walter to page 58, where I think that's the place where we get the best picture of what he's thinking about Katie. He did not know why her presence made him confess things unconfessed in his own mind. He did not know why the victory he came here to share had faded, but it did not matter. He had a peculiar sense of freedom. Her presence always lifted from him a pressure he could not define. He was alone. He was himself. So that's something to think about to answer your question, Walter. And I think we'll definitely get more on their relationship. We didn't focus that much on it today, but it'll get there'll be more as we move forward. And Meryl, I guess, was asking a similar question. Why does Keating stay with Katie? Well, he does through this part of the novel, and we looked at some of the reasons. Let's see what happens in the future.
Okay, I think we're basically at time here. So
all right, let me just see if there's any one of these questions still worth saying something about.
So Ben is asking about Ellsworth Toohey's ideas on architecture, which we get a little glimpse of in these chapters. We learn a little bit about him and about his book.
And Ben puts it as, how do they represent collectivism? Well, collectivism is a word we haven't really said much about yet. That's the word that's usually contrasted with individualism. If Rourke is in contrast with Toohey here, and that makes Rourke some kind of individualist, we're gonna have to figure out why that's true. How does that connect to some of the issues that we've discussed today about how Rourke sees the world in a different way than Keating, that Rourke looks at his work first, that Keating looks at what other people think second. That's the major theme that we've brought out today, that there's this difference between the characters in regards to this idea. We'll have to see what it all adds up to as the plot of this story advances, as we see both Rourke and Keating having to make some difficult decisions as things happen to them, as they themselves interact with each other and with some of the other bigger characters of the book that we haven't even said much about yet, such as Toohey and such as Gail Wynand, who's about to start to play a bigger role in the story. But I think we have to leave it there because we're out of time. I want to thank everybody who's attended today. You guys have done a great job contributing to the conversation, asking questions, contributing in the chat. There have been far more contributions than we've had a chance to comment on, but I just want to encourage everybody to keep doing that because, at some point we'll probably, if you keep doing it, we'll see some of the things that you say and we'll comment on them and we'll try to answer some of your questions. And we really appreciate your interest in all of this. And I guess let me just put up the screen. Again,
yeah, while you're doing that, I'll just say the reason we're doing this, we mentioned in the first session, we're doing this for a couple of reasons. One is we want to make content available for people who are, working from home, social distancing, especially for students and for teachers. And we have our essay contest on the Fountainhead coming up soon. If you know other students or if you know other teachers whose students might be interested in this content, please feel free to share. We want to attract as many people to this content as we can, and we want to make this available as widely as possible.
So. And one way you can share is if you go to the YouTube or the Facebook versions of this recording. These are all archived on our Facebook and YouTube channels. You can just share the embedded video in your own social media, give them a sense of what they can expect from the very discussion that we've just had. And if you have questions you'd like us to discuss in the future, in connection with some of the readings that we're doing, send us an email to students@einrand.org. And I'll just close by reminding you that we're gonna meet next week, same time. 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, right? And we'll be discussing the rest of part one of the novel. That's chapters 9 through 15, pages 103 to 200 in the mass market edition. That's this one right here. And I think we're going to have plenty to talk about. Look forward to the discussion questions for this being posted sometime on Monday to the Fountainhead Facebook page, also to that Zoom registration page, which I gave you the URL before. And I think that is everything. So thanks, everybody, and we will see you all next week.
Bye, everyone. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. If you'd like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast is made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to aynrand.org/membership.